How does the idea of covenant help us understand the word love? Our lesson speaks of covenantal love. Just what does that mean? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, Emeritus Professor of Old Testament in Walla Walla University School of Theology. I am your host and study guide. The theme for our discussions this quarter is God's love and justice. My conversation partners are Brant Berglund from the Walla Walla University School of Theology and Albert Handel, Walla Walla University campus chaplain. So let's go to covenant. Is that good news or bad news? What does it sound like?
Well, are you talking about in the Bible or in today? Because the word covenant today often sounds like regulations on top of red tape, on top of a mountain of problems for almost any way that we use it today.
My immediate thought is homeowners associations and the covenant you enter into to make sure that you don't park a vehicle that's too big in a parking spot and you don't let dogs on your lawn. But biblically, that's a very different question. The idea of covenant with love, that God would make a promise that isn't based on what anyone deserves and then say, I will carry that out in spite of how you act. I will carry out my promise to you. Love then is not his feelings necessarily.
Well, let's take a look at some of the uses of covenant in the early chapters of Genesis. Genesis 6, 17 to 22, where God says, I am going to send a flood on the earth to destroy every living being. Everything on the earth will die. But I will make a covenant with you. Go into the boat with your wife, your sons, your wives, etc. Is that good news?
For some.
But those were spoken to...
to Noah and his family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was sounds to me like good news, doesn't it? Now let's go to another one. Genesis 9. This is after the flood. I am now making my covenant with you and with your descendants. Everything that came out of the boat with you. With these words, I make my covenant with you. I promise that never again will all living beings be destroyed by a flood. Then he finishes by saying, I'm putting my bow in the clouds. It will be a sign of my covenant with the world. Good news or bad news?
Feels like good news.
Yeah. You agree with that, right?
Yeah, both of these are times when God says, I will make a promise to you to take care of you. I will not destroy you again. I won't bring a flood again. Yeah, it's good news.
Now, let's go to the essential passage in Genesis that describes the covenant there, Genesis 15, 17 to 18. It was given when Abraham said, how can I know that the land of Canaan will be mine? Then the Lord instructed Abraham to bring a variety of animals and birds for a sacrifice. He was to cut the animals in half, but not the birds. The climax of this event is described in verses 17 to 18, Genesis 15. When the sun had set and it was dark, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch suddenly appeared and passed between the pieces of the animals. Then and there, the Lord made a covenant with Abram. He said, I promise to give your descendants all this land from the border of Egypt to the Euphrates River. Good news or bad news?
It's good news for Abram.
Yeah.
And yet, Abraham never, according to Hebrews, never saw the fulfillment of them. He always lived as a stranger in the land. So even though he accepted God's covenant promise, he saw that it wasn't fulfilled to him immediately.
Yeah.
I'm struck by your repeated question of, is this good news or bad news, and how I feel, and maybe I'm misreading my conversation partner, Brant, but I feel like every time there's a qualified pause around these, because it does feel like good news, but yet there's a backhanded consideration that I catch in my throat, you know, that God says, no longer am I going to do this horrific thing that I just finished doing. And you want to say, well, why did you do it to begin with? And I will give you this land. And again, my thought is, well, are there other people in the land that are going to lose it as a result?
Yeah.
And so there's this ongoing question of this covenantal relationship being one that does it benefit all people? Is it tended to bless all people? Or is it a covenantal election limited in its grace when given?
I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs that I wrote here because it's really quite a different perspective than what we typically come up with covenant in our day. A covenant of this type requires two parties coming together and making promises to each other, yet Abraham is required to make no promise. God will fulfill his promise no matter what. This is the same kind of assurance that we have today. No matter what I do, no matter how far I fall, no matter how sinful my thoughts, words, or actions may be, nothing can take me out of my Father's hands. There is nothing I could ever do to earn my salvation, and there is nothing I could ever do to keep my salvation. It is all completely a gift of God. But if all that sounds like a blank check, we need to look at a passage in Deuteronomy 7, verses 7 to 10. The Lord did not love you and choose you because you outnumbered other peoples. You were the smallest nation on earth. But the Lord loved you and wanted to keep the promise that he made to your ancestors. That is why he saved you by his great might and set you free from slavery to the king of Egypt. Remember that the Lord your God is the only God and that he is faithful. He will keep his covenant and show his constant love to 1,000 generations of those who love him and obey his commands. But he will not hesitate to punish those who hate him. Now, it's that last line that, what does he mean by that?
Yeah, this goes back to that pause.
Yeah. But the question I have now, are there sufficient safeguards in Scripture to prevent us from taking the covenant promise as a blank check? Hope you know what I mean by that.
Almost a universal salvation. God has already chosen to save everyone and will do so, regardless of my choice in the matter.
Yeah. Now, are there safeguards to keep us from saying those things?
Well, maybe verse 10 is one of those. He will not hesitate to punish those who hate him. I'm given the option to hate him. It's funny to me sometimes that we have developed this picture of a God of love, and then we define love by only those passages that talk about it, but the passages that say he punishes them, well, that can't be the loving nature of God or the just nature of God, as if those are somehow foreign. And I guess I wonder why we've established maybe a picture of God that isn't inclusive of all of these. Like, we're okay with the love part, but I don't like the hate part, because certainly that can't be like God. Well, where did I get that idea of God in the first place, that he doesn't punish those who hate him? It's kind of interesting to me.
Now, let's contrast the testaments. What about the New Covenant? Does the New Testament concept of the New Covenant move us dangerously close to the idea of a blank check? Is there a difference between the New Covenant, Old Testament, New Testament? Christians are sometimes tempted to see the New Covenant as a contrast between the New Testament and Old Testament ideas. Here, the New Covenant is quoted in Jeremiah, as it's quoted in Jeremiah, is crucial. Jeremiah 31:31-34. The time is coming when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel, with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant that I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand and led them out of Egypt, although I was like a husband to them. They did not keep that covenant. The new covenant that I will make with this people will be this. I will put my law within them and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. None of them will have to teach a neighbor to know the Lord, because they will all know me, from the least to the greatest. I will forgive their sins and will no longer remember their wrongs. I, the Lord, have spoken. Now, it seems to me like that's a pretty good idea. Nobody's going to have to tell anybody to love the Lord, because they will already know him. Now, I don't want to go into a great deal of length here, but if you go to Hebrews 8:13, he's quoting the Old Testament, Jeremiah 31. By speaking of a new covenant, God has made the first one old, and anything that becomes old and worn out will soon disappear. Now, one of the things that's very important for me in interpreting the Bible is that you should never try to interpret one passage of Scripture completely by another one. Instead of putting them on top of each other, you lay them side by side.
And you explore the context as well.
Explore the context, yes.
Yeah.
So you never throw anything away. It's always there and can be used for any particular purpose. Now, the idea of covenant loyalty in Psalm 136 may provide grounds for reinforcing the idea of everlasting covenant. Psalm 136, if you've read that one recently, it uses the Hebrew word chesed, which is covenant loyalty, and every verse repeats that. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his chesed endures forever. Oh, give thanks to the God of gods, for his chesed endures forever. Oh, give thanks to the Lord of hosts, for his steadfast love endures forever. In short, God never gives up on us. Even if we turn our backs on him, his steadfast love can be renewed. Now, I have a question for you. Does it help to repeat that again and again and again?
Sounds like some contemporary praise music that has repetitious refrains.
7-11, seven words repeated
11 times.
11 times, yeah.
Sometimes we're just that forgetful that we need that kind of repetitive reminder.
We have the lyrics of a song here. I would love to have the music and to hear what this sounded like and to hear all the people, you know, singing the verses, or if one person singing and then everyone else joining in the chorus, for his steadfast love endures forever. It would be powerful. It would be moving. The repetition is... oh, it's liturgy. And liturgy can be like that.
I was teaching a class this week, and I was highlighting the words evening and morning in Genesis 1 and how many times it happens again. Well, you'd be quite surprised were you to open to Psalms 136, the entire chapter, and see how many times his love endures forever. Happens. It happens way more than evening and morning, over and over and over and over again. Something's important there.
Every single verse is everlasting love endures forever, endures forever. When we think then of covenantal love, and that's what this lesson was about, have we made a case that it's good news or is it ambivalent?
The covenant is good news, but I think, as Alberta has implied, that yes, that there is always a hint that God will make a covenant. The old covenant was a failure because the people failed to enter into it fully by trusting in God, and that's Hebrews' argument in Hebrews 8. The new covenant, God says, this covenant will be different, but it's the same law. It's just written in a different heart, in a different place, right? The human heart now. And that's good news, but there's also a suggestion that maybe people won't allow it. They won't allow him to do that. So there's a hint that there's some sadness to it. Mostly it's good news.
The one of the things that we'll learn as we go through this quarter is that justice and love, there's a tension there, but they will be brought together at the end. Thank you to Brant and Albert for their contributions today. And I want to thank Kristen Byerly, our program engineer. And for all of you, thank you for the good word. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.